extra time.
Hello and welcome back to the Extra Time podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and I'm once again joined by European football expert, Doogie Critchley. How are you, Doogie?
Yeah, that's very generous. Expert, not sure about that. But no, I'm good, thank you. I'm good. I had a nice weekend filled with sport. There was a lot of cricket on, there was rugby, there was, of course, football. So I was in absolute heaven. It was very nice indeed. How was yours?
Yeah, it was pretty good. I've got to say, I also enjoyed the football this weekend. It was very entertaining, and I'm kind of glad that European football is back in midweek, because right now, I obviously enjoy watching films and TV in the evening with my wife, but we have literally no variation in what we do at the moment. So it's kind of nice when there's a football match midweek and it just feels a little bit different, because otherwise every week blurs into the next.
Where anything could happen in some of the football games, as we saw. And Arsenal actually put in a great performance, Pat. You must be delighted with that.
Yeah, well, I think, since Christmas, we've been pretty good, It's just that if you take half a season to discover a remotely functional lineup, then it takes quite a long time to get into the top half of the table. But yeah, you know what? I said to myself back in the autumn, you know what? If I could be guaranteed that we wouldn't be relegated, I'd relax a bit. And now I have relaxed a bit. So, it's all right. It's fine. We're staying up, I think. How was it for you watching former Sunderland icon Josh Maguire score in the Premier League? Was that upsetting?
Yeah, I mean, decidedly sort of mixed emotions. I'm really pleased that he's got to the Premier League in the end, but I would have been, more happy if he hadn't left sort of 3 days before the transfer window shut in, I think it was January 2019 now, when we were well on track for promotion from League One. Obviously, a good move to Bordeaux for him, did okay there in sort of limited minutes. And I didn't actually watch Fulham versus Everton last night, but I've told it was two tap-ins from Henry Hill. So we'll see how he gets on it. And I'm pleased for him back at his boyhood club, but I'm not a fan of his agent, really, who sort of ruined our season that year.
Have Sunderland been bought by someone yet?
Yes, we've been bought by Kyle Dreyfus, whose dad used to own Marseille. And he's 22, which is a little bit concerning. But actually, he's appointed a new sporting director. We've got Lee Johnson as our manager at the moment. We're doing, we're doing all right. We should be in the promotion sort of mix. But he's definitely got bags of cash, which will certainly help in the long run.
Are you still on track for, I can't remember what your predicted timeline was, but wasn't it, Champions League 2026, something like that?
Yeah, when we looked like we were being bought by the by the guys at Microsoft or whatever, I got pretty overexcited. But no, we are not on track for the Champions League by 2028, I think it was. We're on track for the Championship for the next 5 years, I reckon.
Okay, well, I mean, that overall would be an improvement. I mean, it is ridiculous that a club with, what, isn't the stadium of 40,000 seater or something?
Yeah, it's
absolutely 40, massive.
Yeah, it's 46,000. I think it's bigger than Stamford Bridge, so it's pretty massive.
Oh, everything's bigger than Stamford Bridge. that's like Anfield size, and yet you're in League One. It's absolutely ridiculous. So I'm up for Sunderland to come back up now.
Me too.
I'm ready for it. Well, shall we talk today about a very different football trajectory? Because Tottenham earlier in the season were really, really flying, and we kind of felt in the summer like they'd really addressed their problems. Like, it looked like they'd gone out and they'd maybe not found the perfect players, because you never really know, but it seemed like they'd looked at all their problem areas, found signings to deal with them, and obviously started the season at a ferocious pace. I mean, incredible form from Son and Kane has really powered them up the league. But since, I'd say, November, December, they've really, really stalled. And now Jose Mourinho is under some serious pressure. Obviously, this weekend, can't do much about playing Man City in the form they're in at the moment. But Spurs have endured some really disappointing results. And it kind of feels like Mourinho is going to need to work pretty hard to stay in that job. So today we decided to talk about how he can save his job, and more broadly, how Spurs can improve themselves over, I guess, the next couple of transfer windows. So, Dukes, what do you think about Spurs this season? What do you think's going on? How have they been performing? Do you have any major takeaways from your dive into the stats?
Yeah, it's been, as you say, a pretty mixed bag. I think if you'd asked most Spurs fans what they thought of how they were playing in sort of December, I think they would have been pretty delighted, really. I mean, the results were very strong. They obviously went on that great run, beating Man City, beating Arsenal, and, you know, they were flying high on the table. But since then, it's slightly fallen apart. And I actually think it's mainly down to a lack of confidence and just basic defensive errors. Like we've seen in recent weeks, Lloris have a few clangers, not least against Liverpool. We've seen Davinson Sanchez embarrass himself on a couple of occasions against Everton and Man City at the weekend. Alderweireld doesn't look as solid as usual. Serge Aurier gave away that penalty against Leicester City, which sort of started this poor run. And it feels like with Mourinho's style of play, you've almost got less to give in that sort of sense, because you're always, you know, you're facing so much pressure on your own area. You've got less control of the ball. So if you're getting basic defensive errors, it's going to really come a cropper. And for people thinking that this podcast feels quite familiar, we did do it in July 2020, and we did a how to fix Spurs then. And we actually recommended some players that I think would have made a massive difference. It was Nnamdi Mukiele at right back, John Stones at centre back. And I remember some of the comments at the time being like, Spurs are way better than John Stones. I mean, how wrong they have been proved. I think you suggested Camavinga as a DM, Junior Firpo as a left back. Odson Edouard was in the shout as well. André Silva, of course, who's played so well at Eintracht Frankfurt. So, you know, we suggest all these names for Spurs in the summer, but actually, as you say, I think they had a great window by all accounts. They looked at their problems and they sort of spent a hell of a lot of money. They spent a net £88 million. They brought in Lo Celso, permanently, obviously, Reguilon, £27 million. Doherty, £15 million. Højbjerg, £12 million. Rodon, obviously one for the future, just under 11. Also brought in a backup striker in Carlos Vinicius on loan. Brought back Gareth Bale on loan, which I wasn't that hot about at the time, given his injury issues over the last few years. And actually, I know it was only a one-year loan, but he was still being paid £15 million, which is a lot in wages on 1 year, and it just hasn't worked out so far at all. And they also brought in Joe Hart on a free. So it felt like Spurs were slightly, I think they probably had the second best window, to be honest, after Chelsea. And they went in with a certain degree of optimism, despite the fact that the results at the back end of last year were pretty mixed. I mean, Spurs fans love to say that they were 14th when Mourinho took over, and only Liverpool, City and United took more points than them towards the end of the year. But the results were actually decidedly mixed towards the end of the that year, with that draw against Bournemouth, I seem to remember, a draw against Crystal Palace as well. Like, it wasn't fantastic. Great summer, and then they had that disaster on the opening day against Everton. But then they bounced back really well. They went unbeaten in their next 11 league games, winning 7 and drawing 4, to top the table for 4 game weeks. And considering where they are now, Spurs atop the table seems absolutely mental, almost as mental as Southampton briefly being top of the table as well. And on the 6th of December, as I said, when they beat Arsenal 2-0, they were ahead of Liverpool on goal difference, and only Liverpool and United had scored more than their 23 league goals, and no side had conceded fewer than their 9. And in fact, going into that clash against Liverpool at Anfield, they had won 15 of their previous 21 games in all competitions, scoring 53 goals and averaging 2.5 goals a game. Now, obviously, a lot of those goals were scored in the Europa League, but still, there was a sense that Mourinho had sort of adjusted his tactics. Spurs were controlling games. Son and Kane, he was getting the most out of them. They were in phenomenal form. And things were pretty rosy in their North London garden. But since then, absolute disaster. They played 11 in the league, won 3, drawn 2 and lost 6 to Liverpool, times 2, Leicester, Chelsea, City. Obviously quite difficult games, those, you would say. Particularly Chelsea, they were just under a new management in Tuchel. City, I don't think any of them, many people expected them to even get a point at the Etihad. There's no shame in that, in the way that City are. But it was really those two defeats to Liverpool that just showed the gulf in class between a side who are really underperforming at the moment in Liverpool, and a side who just looked miles away from even that Liverpool, that iteration of Liverpool. So it is a little bit troubling, and they rank 15th for points in that run of 11 games, just 3 ahead of 18th place Newcastle. And they're now 9th at the time of writing, 17 points, off leaders Man City, and 4 off 4th place Liverpool, though they do have a game in hand. So with the sort of problems going on around the Premier League in the teams below sort of 2nd and 3rd, really, below Leicester, you know, there's still a chance that they could make the Champions League. But I think most Spurs fans are now seriously worried about the trajectory their club is going on, and the football, more importantly, they're playing under Mourinho, and the sort of confidence of their side right now. They're now out of the FA Cup, obviously, with that loss to Everton. And now it looks like the Europa League is their only chance of silverware this season, given that, most people would say Man City are heavy, heavy favourites for the Carabao Cup final, which now feels like one of the most important games in Mourinho's career, which, considering he's played Champions League finals, El Clasicos, Milan derbies, seems bizarre, but it actually is now for his current sake. So, troubling times for Spurs. But, Pat, what have you sort of noticed sort of tactically in this downturn?
Well, I mean, a lot of it is stuff that Spurs fans have noticed. I mean, like, a lot of it's fairly obvious, right? We've kind of said for a long time that our concern with Mourinho is maybe that he is too conservative these days for the strength of the league. Because of the way the league is, it's not like it was in the mid-2000s where you could play for draws away at tough sides. There are too many tough sides, and now you've got to try and beat them. But one of my real, real worries here is that Son and Kane are having the seasons of their lives, you know. Son has got 19 Premier League goal involvements. Kane has got 24. And yet the attack is still not great. The attack is rated as the 11th best in the Prem, like by expected goals.
Wow.
Which, when you consider that you've got two of the form players in the league, like, that is really quite troubling. And the defence isn't great either. Like, the defence is 7th or 8th best, and their expected goals difference per game is now at plus 0.13. So with each game, they on average are like 0.13 better than their opponents. That's 10th best in the Prem. It's now behind Arsenal, which, when you consider the way that Arsenal played for the first half of the season, really, is ridiculous, to be honest with you. And early in the season, we were saying, oh, this is interesting. You know, you're watching Spurs and you kind of saw them being quite aggressive. They seem to be pressing quite a lot and pressing quite high up. That's completely disappeared. Mm. They've now got the 10th best passes per defensive action. So that's, you know, how many opposition passes it takes before Spurs attempt a tackle or a foul. So, like, they're the 10th most aggressive side in the league, which is, you know, obviously average. And they're also not great at playing around an opposition press. They rank 11th for opposition passes per defensive action. So they're not particularly good at dealing with pressure when they come under it. To me, when I watch them, their plan for dealing with the press is just playing a quick ball out of defence to Harry Kane, hoping he can hold it up and maybe spring Son while the rest of the team, like, gradually gets forward.
Mm.
So when you look at their tackle numbers and see where those tackles are happening, you can really see the way that territory works out in Spurs games. 55% of their tackles are coming in their own defensive third. So they're playing really quite deep. And move forward very quickly.
We saw this against Chelsea in particular. I remember there were so many times where they got the ball at the edge of their box after they'd managed to stop a Chelsea counter-attack, and they had absolutely no way of building play whatsoever. Højbjerg was literally pointing at players about where to be. There was absolutely no movement around him. Sissoko wasn't doing it at all. And you just felt like not only were they failing to put Chelsea under any pressure whatsoever when they had the ball, they couldn't get around Chelsea's pretty weak press in that game. Like, Chelsea weren't, like, incredible going, you know, we're defending, that is. So I just think that passes per defensive action couldn't have been more obvious in that game.
Yeah, and I think in the Liverpool game as well. Like, obviously in the Liverpool game, you had Kane go off. And look, you know, a player like Kane going off is going to affect any side. But before that, Spurs were reasonably dangerous, I thought, when they got the ball out to Kane quite quickly. But as soon as Kane went off, it wasn't like the structure was still in place, but they just had a worse player in place of Kane. It was like they then had literally no plan for how they were going to get up the pitch. And that was really, really troubling to me. And they, generally speaking, this inability to dominate territory is so clear, and it's been clear all season. I mean, there's a statistic called deep completions, right? Which is passes completed within 20 yards of the opposition goal. So your ability to just kind of keep possession around the opposition's area. Non-crosses, these are. And only Newcastle, Wolves and West Brom have completed fewer deep completions than Tottenham this season. But you'd expect that they'd be solid in defence at least. But only West Brom, Burnley and Newcastle have allowed more than Spurs. So it feels like it's really easy to have the ball around Tottenham's third. But really, but it's really hard for them to do the same to you.
Yeah.
And to me, the issue, or the key issue here, is the third attacker. Like, the third attacker is such a problem because Son and Kane are amazing and then there's nothing. And the refusal to really play Dele Alli, I think, is an issue here because he's the only guy on the side who's really shown, you know, great ability at the top level to get lots of shots and key passes. But I still think you can see in the numbers the way that Mourinho is hamstringing his attackers. So the most commonly deployed guys on the right wing for Spurs this season have been Lucas Moura and Steven Bergwijn. And they've averaged .25 expected goals and assists per 90 for Moura, 0.2 for Bergwijn. And they're taking 1.9 shots and 1.7 shots per game, respectively. Taking and creating. So those are chances created and shots taken.
Wow, that's not great.
You know, and this isn't something that's always been the case for them. I mean, last year, Lucas Moura was at double that number. Bergwijn was at double that number, nearly. So what we're seeing instead is those guys are being asked to defend. Both averaging around 17 pressures a game, which is pretty good. Moura makes nearly 3 tackles and interceptions a match. Bergwijn is on 2, which isn't a lot, but it's a lot more than Son and Kane, who are down on kind of the 1 to 1.3 range. So this third attacker is really there, almost playing like a wing back.
Yeah.
You know, like if they can get forward and attack, then great. But most of the time, their job is don't get caught out of position. Make sure you're protecting the defence. And, you know, the other attackers have had basically no look in. Bale's had a couple of hundred minutes. Vinicius has had a couple of hundred minutes. Even Lo Celso's only had about 400 minutes. Ali, until this weekend, had 70 minutes in the Premier League, which is absolutely nuts. In fact, in the whole squad, I saw that nobody, apart from Son and Kane, had played 500 minutes and taken more than 1.1 shots a game. So they're getting absolutely no attacking output out of everyone. Sergio Reguilón is one of their most dangerous players. It's really, really troubling. And what we were talking about, what I was mentioning before about Mourinho being too conservative, I think is so obvious in so many fixtures this season. You know, you look at games like the Fulham game, the Wolves game, the Palace game. These were games where Spurs took the lead and then they just sat back and defended.
Mm.
And they eventually just conceded goals. And if you look at those games, have you seen those XG charts where it shows the shots and, you know, the quality of them over the course of the match?
Yeah.
So it goes up each time there's a shot. In each of those games, I was looking at them, and basically the first half, Spurs create a decent amount, halftime hits, and nothing for the rest of the game. Just flatline for the rest of the game. And I just think, with the attacking talent you've got, and given the fact that Spurs clearly can't execute the defence Mourinho wants them to a level good enough to get Champions League, why isn't he just playing a more attacking style? Why isn't he just saying, you know what, if the system is you shoot, we shoot, basically like a basketball game, your attackers are less likely to score than my attackers because I have Son and Kane. And I just think that he should say, you know what, this lineup actually lends itself much better to a really attacking, like, outshooting the opposition style, kind of like Leeds,
yeah,
rather than to a let's sit deep and counter setup, because that just seems ridiculous to me. And it's clearly not working. And I don't think they've really got much of a prayer of Champions League football now, because I think Liverpool, Chelsea, Man United and City are all better. I think Leicester are better. I think Villa might even be better. You know, now there are teams like Arsenal, there's Everton in the mix. Like, I just don't see how they do it. And if they end up finishing behind a team like Arsenal or Everton this season, I don't think Mourinho survives. I really don't, because they had such a head start. And now it's slightly embarrassing what's going on now, because the squad is so much better than this.
100%. And that's where the criticism kind of comes in about his sort of whether he's been left behind by modern football, his inability to adapt what should be fairly simple. And most of the time in post-match press conferences, he's kind of making out that it's kind of the team's fault. He said, we're in a sad moment and I told the team to be more attacking and all this sort of chat. But I just don't think that could be true. Like, they look so sort of toothless with the ball at times. And you've got Steven Bergwijn, who was a fantastic attacker in Holland, who started, you know, phenomenally well in England with that goal against Man City, I believe, on his debut. And he's now playing as a right wing back, as you say. And when they play a back four, it's pretty much a back seven, because Sissoko drops in as well in between the centre halves. And you are just left with Kane and Son miles away from everyone else. And you've actually got some very good link players in this squad, like Ndombele. Lamela has a very good purpose for that. Like, it doesn't have to function like this with that squad that they've created. And actually, as you say, if you look at the strength of their squad, their weakest element is probably centre-back. So if you want to exert more authority in games, you probably need to change the onus and maybe flip it a little bit and try and stay a little bit higher up the pitch, put a little less pressure on your own centre-backs deeper towards their own box. Because we've seen in recent weeks, they'll just get passed around. Like, Man City found it far too easy. I know we all heap praise on Gundogan for those goals at the weekend, but it was very easy to find space in and around those centre-backs, and they're just not good enough in one-on-one battles. So I just feel like he's asking for problems at the moment, and at the moment they're just coming straight through.
Yeah, I mean, it just... I don't really... He obviously went and bought Doherty in the summer and thought that that was going to shore him up at right back, and then he's kind of barely been used. Reguilon has been a regular mostly when he's been fit, but the centre-back pairing of Dier and Alderweireld just seems... I don't know, like, it seems like a kind of throwback centre-back pairing where Mourinho wants someone really aggressive, really big, really aerially dominant, and that's why he puts Dier in there. But Dier's positional sense is just completely out of whack. I mean, the Gundogan goal that was assisted by Ederson at the weekend, it took like several viewings to see where Dier was and what he was doing. And I'm really, really concerned about like what the plan is actually meant to be. And that was with Sanchez there, who actually has the athleticism the other two lack. Yeah. They were still getting caught out. So I don't know. I mean, I guess that we should probably talk. Would you rather talk about centre-back first then, or will you rather talk about right-back?
Why don't you take centre-backs, just because I feel like that is the slightly more pressing concern. And I think in the summer they were going for Milan Skriniar and that didn't quite materialise. And actually that looked like the area that they probably should have prioritised maybe a little bit more than they did.
Yeah, I think... I mean, they brought in Joe Rodon, and I haven't watched a huge amount of him, but I thought that he was very impressive in the Liverpool game. And hopefully he will develop. But it's clear that still the preferred partnership is Alderweireld and Dier. Mm. Dier's played, I think, 86% of the available minutes this season. Alderweireld is on about 63%. Sanchez has played about 750 minutes. Rodon, I think, is about 370. So it's very clear, you know, who Mourinho wants playing there, given his choice. And the thing is about Mourinho centre-backs is you're not actually required to step out of defence that much. What he wants from you is that you win aerial duels and you're generally in position. And ideally, you can pass a little bit. But you don't have to be, like, playing incredible passes over the top, you know. So Dier and Alderweireld both making between 1.5 and 2 tackles and interceptions a game this season. That's not very much. They rank last and second last for pressures in the squad. So again, you know, they're not racing out of the back line to do much, which makes it even weirder when Dier kind of disappears upfield. And they're not particularly relied on for passing either. I think they combine for 6 passes into the final third a game, which given, you know, the way that Alderweireld was used in the Pochettino days is quite strange. It feels like it's not really playing to his strengths, but whatever. As I said before, aerially dominant defenders, Mourinho's bread and butter. So Dier wins 67% of his aerial duels. And to me, I was like, this is going to be it. Like, I guarantee that this is going to be it. Like, this is why he's put him in, because he's big. He just loves a big guy. And so I was thinking when I was looking for a centre-back, we want someone obviously kind of under 26 or so, I think. But, you know, Mourinho's not going to want someone too young because he's Mourinho. We want somebody who's good in the air and ideally who doesn't get beaten too much on the deck. And I ended up looking at Duya Chaletata.
Nice.
Who is a centre-back playing for Marseille. He's 24 years old. Obviously, Marseille might need to sell this summer. He was linked to Liverpool, actually, in the January window. He's been linked with Premier League moves in the past. He currently ranks seventh in Europe for aerial win rate at 82%. And he's been above 70% in the last 3 seasons. So a clearly dominant presence in the air. 2.4 tackles and interceptions per game. You know, that's fine. He's been playing under Villas-Boas. So again, playing in quite a rigid defensive setup. Also doesn't make many pressures per game. But he's actually quite successful when he does pressure the ball. So Alderweireld and Dier win the ball about 31-30% of the time when they pressure someone, which is pretty high. It means that when they see the opportunity to go and close someone down, they stand a pretty good chance of getting the ball. Chaletasar is at like 36%. So you also get the sense that he has good reading of the game. He has a good nose for an opportunity to steal possession. He's actually had better success on long balls than both of those Spurs defenders this season. I think he's completing nearly 70% of his long balls, which is above Dier and Alderweireld. But really here, you know, contract up in 2023, playing for a Ligue 1 club who are going to need to sell. He's probably not like a lights out defender. He's, you know, he's not like the toast of the continent in a way that somebody like Skriniar is. But I think he's going to be extremely reliable. He's going to be ready to come in and play. And I don't think you're going to have to spend an arm and a leg on him. And given that I think we are going to need to talk about attackers, Yeah. I'm inclined to think that if you can get a centre back for, you know, sub 30 mil, you should probably do that. I mean, the other guy I looked at was Milenkovic at Fiorentina, who's still only 23. Obviously, he can also play at right back. And he's got kind of that Mourinho right back build, you know, where he's like far too big and gangly to play as a fullback, really. But again, hugely dominant in the air, 84% aerial wins, pretty decent passer into the final third. And he betters all these guys for tackles and interceptions per game, which I think is partially a function of sometimes playing wide, more pressures as well. But really good long ball success, 81% long ball success. So he might be an interesting one as well. He might give them a little bit more flexibility. But fundamentally, Mourinho will experiment with a back three from time to time, but he's never going to commit to it in the long term. So I feel like what you want here is a conventional defender in a conventional four at the back. So that's why I think Chaletetal might be an interesting guy. But I think a lot of it, the success of a signing like this really depends on what you do at right back, because the right back situation is just a strange one to me.
Yeah, the right back is really weird. And yeah, I like those both of those shouts for centre back. I really like Milenkovic, actually. I think he's a really great prospect. And I feel like maybe AC Milan, if they're looking to move on from Simon Kjær this summer or at some stage, not suggesting they need to, because he's been great up until this weekend against Spezia, when the whole Milan ties slightly fell apart, and they don't make that Tomori deal permanent, then maybe Milenkovic will go there. Or maybe if Inter do sell Skriniar, they'll be looking at him. But he'll definitely be on the radar of a lot of top clubs this summer. But yeah, right back is really interesting. And I remember when we did this last summer, we suggested Serginho Dest, Youssef Attal and Alvaro Odriozola as a slight wild card for this position. And it's not a position in the same way as centre back or this attacker we're going to talk about, which is probably quite as necessary as those two. But it just feels like Doherty and Aurier, neither are really Mourinho's, like, he's not loving either of those options. And it's kind of obvious to see with Doherty. Like, I feel like he has just been disappointing when he's been played. I mean, admittedly, it's very different coming out of a five-man defence at Wolves, where you had a big licence to roam down that up and down that flank, create a lot of width, crossing in for, you know, Jimenez, Neto, Traore, etc., to go to a very defensive Mourinho system. But Doherty, it just hasn't looked great. He's made 10 league appearances so far. He ranks 13th for minutes in the squad. 3.4 tackles and interceptions per 90 might look good on paper, but he's only successful with 59% of his tackles, which for a fullback is not atrocious, but it's not great either. And that's down from 77% last term. And his attacking output has just completely collapsed. Now, I'm not going to put that all on Doherty's shoulders, but it's lower than Aurier's as well, which suggests that he's just not really found his feet yet in North London. 0.1 shots per 90, which is down from 1.1. We know all of Spurs' attackers are struggling with shots right now. And just 0.7 key passes and 0.4 dribbles, which is less than half of his tally from last year. He's also a terrible presser, by all accounts. He's successful with just 19% of his pressures, which is the worst in the squad. Hugo Lloris was the only guy who was lower, and obviously he's a goalkeeper, so he doesn't do pressures. So it's pretty damaging. And Aurier's, for context, is 9% higher at 28%. So he's just not performing as you'd expect Mourinho fullback. And whether Mourinho, I know that in the documentary, you remember, He points out Doherty as a real threat when they play Wolves, and he's all about his pace and his strength and his height, and he's like, he's a real threat. And maybe that was partly Mourinho's thinking, but I just feel like he's been slightly disappointed with what Doherty can bring with the ball in particular. And Aurier has, I feel, been much better than last year for a start, and also looked pretty solid in the back four despite that error against Leicester when he gave away that penalty aside. And you just feel like those consistent errors that he makes, you know, once every 15 games or so, is just going to cost him his long-term future under Mourinho. But if I was going to sell either of them, I'd definitely sell Doherty, which seems quite unlikely given his age. I think he's 28 or 29 and he's only just arrived. I would have thought that in terms of who they should have brought in, like James Justin at Leicester would have been an awesome addition, but he's obviously not going to go there. Brilliant all-round defender. I think he's probably been, put this on Twitter last week, I think he's probably been the best defender this year outside of Man City for me, James Justin. I just think he's been absolutely awesome. Luke Shaw probably in with a shout as well, but I just think James Justin has been absolutely class. Emerson, who's a defensive behemoth at Real Betis, they could possibly look at him. And Barca would be keen to offload him as well, but I actually think the guy they should go for is 23-year-old Lille right back Zeki Selik as well. He's racked up 88 appearances for the club since joining from Turkey in 2018, contributing 3 goals and 10 assists. And what he's not like He's a very solid defender, which is first and foremost what Mourinho will look for. He's not going to change the game with a 50-yard raking pass. He's not a Trent Alexander-Arnold reborn. He's not like a massive attacking threat, but he's just very, very solid. 3.2 tackles and interceptions, 3.2 tackles per 90, 1.8 interceptions, so 5 tackles and interceptions per 90. Only centre mid Benjamin Andre takes more at Lille. And he's a very solid presser as well, 15.8 per game, which isn't as good as Aurier's 22. But when he does go in for the ball, as we're talking about with Duje's Chaleta Sarr, he's often coming away with the ball. He comes away with the ball 30% compared to Aurier's 28%. And he's just much more solid. He rarely makes errors. I feel like he's been on the radar of a lot of top clubs around Europe for a while. There was interest from Everton, I think, in the summer. And he's a very good dribbler as well. 5.1 progressive carries, which is a carry that goes over 10 yards per game versus Aurier's 3.2, and 3.2 passes into the final third per 90 compared to Aurier's 1.1. So I feel like he's got a bit of everything that Mourinho would look for. And if you want to rotate him in with Aurier over the next 2 years for a guy who's only rated at £18 million, I feel like it's quite a good snip. If Lille go on and win Ligue 1, I mean, they're still in the mix in February as we stand, which is an amazing achievement for Christophe Galtier's side, then maybe they'll be able to put up a bit of fight and they'll be able to persuade him to stay with Champions League football. But I think Zeki Sélec would be an awesome pickup.
Yeah, I mean, Lille's defence has been absolutely fantastic for a long time now. And it pretty much coincides with Sélec's arrival. I mean, I think since 2018, they've conceded under a goal a game in Ligue 1. Since 2018.
It's incredible.
And this is, you know, given the fact that obviously they lost Gabriel in that time. They're now betting in Sven Botman. They've been playing Jose Font a lot, who's well into his mid-30s. It's really, really impressive stuff. And you imagine that the transition maybe from Lille's defensive setup to a Mourinho defensive setup might actually be relatively smooth, right? You know,
or at least
smoother than coming from playing right wing back in a back five like Doherty did at Wolves, which always seemed strange that Mourinho kind of thought we'll get similar attacking output out of this guy, given that he was playing in a totally different system at Wolves. It just seems like a really odd thought process there. I can't quite work it out, but I think Sélec is a fantastic signing. I think if a club like Spurs doesn't get him, then you know that a team like, maybe not Leicester because I'm not sure they're looking in that position, but you know a team of that level who are a little bit clever will probably go and pinch him off Lille. But maybe actually now it needs to be a club the size of Spurs because Lille are doing so well. So I think that would make an awful lot of sense. I think that even though they've now been sold, Lille are probably still going to want to make some sales in the summer. And I think that they'll rather sell, you know, Sélec, maybe Botman.
Although Botman's just that little bit younger, I suppose. I think they'll try and keep hold of Botman. But yeah, there looks like there's going to be a 40 million plus move coming in for Botman, which might be quite difficult to turn down.
Well, and it depends, you know, who it lets you keep. If they think, oh, well, actually, we can sell Botman and it lets us keep Renato Sanchez, or we can sell Sélec and it lets us keep Boubacary Soumaré or Jonathan David.
Or Jonathan Balmer, Bamba or whatever.
Yeah, then maybe there's like a little bit of a calculation that goes on there. But yeah, I think that's actually a fantastic signing. And I think that if you've got, say, Chaleta Tsar or Milenkovic and Sélec, then I think that would probably improve Spurs basically instantaneously. It's hard to imagine them getting much worse, but I think really the key position here, based on everything we've said so far, is getting in that third nailed on starting attacker. What kind of player have you been looking for here?
I find this really unfair because, not unfair, I found it difficult because I do really like Steven Bergwijn. As I sort of intonated earlier, I think he works really hard for the team. He's not, you know, kicked up a fuss. He was really consistent at PSV, averaged at least 15 league goal contributions for 3 consecutive seasons. And I just feel really sorry for him, to be totally honest. I feel like he's been brought over under false illusions of what it was going to be like playing in the Premier League. And now he's playing right wing back and it's just not great. But as you said, we've got to find that third attacker, because between Bale, Bergwijn, Lo Celso, Lucas, Vinicius Jr., Ali and Lamela, there are 7 league goal contributions between them. Which is pretty damning. Their league goal contributions in the league from Spurs: Kane 24, Son 19, Ndombele is next with 4, and Højbjerg is after that with 4. So they definitely need more creativity. They definitely need a player who's capable of holding onto the ball in the final third as well, which is not really Lucas Moura's strength, I don't particularly think. And Bale just doesn't look like the same player he was even two years ago, really. I feel like if they could get him, there was lots of talk about Angel Di Maria in January. I think he would be an awesome pickup on a free. There was talk of it in January, as I said. He's worked under Mourinho beforehand. He's 32, obviously. But so if you got him on a one-year deal or an 18-month deal, his fitness is still pretty good. Having said that, he's currently out at the moment. It looks like he's going to miss that Barcelona game as well. But he still contributed 9 goals and 10 assists in 24 league and Champions League games this season. 2.7 shots, 3.3 key passes. Like, that's massive. That would be one of the best figures in the Premier League. Obviously, Ligue 1 is a slightly different level. But even Ligue 1, I think this year has been awesome with the amount of competition, the amount of great names, great managers going to Ligue 1. Like, Ligue 1 is not a league to be taking the piss out of anymore, I feel. 1.9 dribbles as well, 0.84 expected goals and assists per 90. Failing that, I feel like Florian Thauvin could be a good option from Marseille. Looks like Marseille, as you mentioned earlier, going to be absolute chaos there this summer, so tuck in, everyone. So Florian Thauvin or Di Maria, but a little bit of a wild card that I wanted to mention as well, who I don't think Mourinho is going to go for. But Silas Wamangituka from Stuttgart. Love this guy.
I just recommended this guy as a potential upgrade on Iosi Perez for Leicester. But I think that actually this would be a great signing for Spurs. Because I was just going to say, like, the Di Maria thing, my issue with the Di Maria thing is I don't think he does the defensive work Mourinho wants.
Yeah.
And I also sort of feel like, I know Di Maria can play wide, but really he's an attacking midfielder. Mm. And I feel like if you're going to buy attacking midfielder, Just play Dele Alli instead.
Yeah. Or Lo Celso is going to come back from injury as well.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I feel like they're maybe a little bit stacked in the 10. Maybe Di Maria wasn't the one, but Wamangituka, this is a proper, proper wide guy, guys. He is awesome to watch in full flight. He is absolutely rapid. So he's playing at Stuttgart. Yeah. He's playing in their 3-4-2-1 formation. He generally plays on either flank in the four in midfield. And a lot of people have shown interest in Nico Gonzalez. Spurs are apparently looking at him in January as well. Wataru Endo, their defensive midfielder, or Oro Mangala. But Wamangituka, for me, is the real star. He only joined from Paris FC, the Ligue 2 side, in August 2019 for £7.2 million. And he was really good last year in the Bundesliga 2 without many people sort of taking much notice of him. 7 goals and 6 assists as they finished second behind Arminia Bielefeld. And they've taken the top flight by storm this year, and he's been absolutely awesome. So far in the Bundesliga, 19 games, 11 goals and 3 assists. 2.3 shots, 1.2 key passes and 2.1 dribbles, which doesn't sound, none of that's exceptional, but it's when you watch him play, like, he just gets you off your seat. He's absolutely rapid, and he's shown great finishing ability as well. I can't see Mourinho going for him this summer, and I actually don't think he'll ever go for him, to be honest. He's not really a Mourinho style player. There's too much risk with him. There's almost too much excitement for Mourinho. I think his little tick will probably give way. But Wamangituka, big game player as well. He's got a goal against Hoffenheim, an assist versus Bayern, 2 goals and assist versus Dortmund, and a goal versus Gladbach. He also scored one of my favourite goals I've seen this season. It was an 80 metre sort of solo run versus Mainz. And there was another great moment. I was watching his highlights last week as well, preparing for this. There was another great moment against, I can't remember who it was. It might have been Freiburg. He rounded the keeper and then took the ball to the line and did that classic house move where you just stand on the line waiting for the keeper to run back, and then he just boots in as the keeper comes.
Yeah, went mental though. Everyone was furious.
Yeah, exactly. They absolutely hated it. So Wamangituka, I enjoy your comedy, I enjoy your style of play, and I think he'll be in line for a move this summer. I don't think it'll be to Mourinho's Spurs, but he's definitely one to keep an eye on.
I think he's definitely the right sort of player though. Like, that's the thing. Like, it's,
he'd be great on the break.
And this is kind of my issue, you know, with a club like Man United. You're like, there are these players who'd really, really improve them, but you know they won't go for them because it's just not the sort of player they go for. Mm. Like, if Levy said to Mourinho, we are going to get you Wamangituka, probably once he arrived, Mourinho would love him because, like you say, his defensive work rate's great. He's incredibly fast, so he's going to be able to track back and get forward. He's pretty versatile. You know, he's played as a wing back, but he can play behind the striker. He could probably fill in up front as well. Like, he's just got absolutely everything you could want. And what, he's 21?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I just don't know what else you would want from a player. Like, I suppose you can always wait another season and see how it goes. But right now it feels like the issue is that while Moura and Bergwijn are better than they look, they're not the sorts of players to create something out of nothing while also defending. Whereas Wamanga Tuke is potentially one of those players. You know, somebody who can track back and yet can just do something magical because he's got so many exceptional qualities.
He's so athletic. And it's the sort of signing. It always annoys me when someone like Wesley Fofana goes from St Etienne to Leicester City and suddenly everyone takes him seriously as a great prospect. Like, he was doing this at St Etienne. Like, big clubs, like top six clubs in the Premier League, need to stop waiting until they do it at a middling club. No offence to Leicester City, but that's where they are in the global standing. And just take these, you know, relatively low risk, low price sort of moves on the likes of Wamanga Tuke, on the Fofanas of this world, and see what they're like. And then if that doesn't work out, sell them on after a year or two and you probably get your money back. Like, stop waiting until a player excels and the value goes through the roof.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing the same thing with Rafinha now, right? Yeah. Like, Rafinha had great numbers last season. It was like 0.5, 0.6 expected goals and assists per game in Ligue 1 with Rennes. Like, really good dribble numbers as well. Great progressive passing numbers. Well, now he's 24 years old. I think he's got something like 9 goal involvements in the league in a season where he's adapting on a side which has only just come up to the Premier League and has had some pretty rough beatings. Like, now people are talking about him as a possible, you know, Man United signing. And you think, well, you could have got him for 20, 25 million. And if it hadn't worked out, you could have sold him back to France for about the same money, probably. Like, what is the risk?
Yeah, drives me crazy.
Well, yeah. And I think this is one of the problems with hiring a guy like Mourinho. Mourinho costs you a lot of money in wages, but he also costs you money in the players that he ostracizes. And he costs you money in refusing to sign people at knockdown prices who are gambles. What he really wants is people that he knows. He knows what they are. He knows that they've achieved. You know, I kind of feel like a really good forward for Mourinho would be somebody like Richarlison.
Nice.
Like, when I was looking for a signing for him, I was thinking, you know what? Richarlison seems like the kind of guy. He's really hard work. He's a big aerial threat. He's a really big guy, actually. He completes a lot of dribbles, but while he is skillful, it's not necessarily because of his skill that he completes a lot of dribbles. He's just really kind of powerful.
He's got a bit of a gritty streak as well.
Yes, exactly. And I feel like he's one of those players that people often forget about when they talk about Brazilians. People are like, oh, I love like Brazilian football. It's so full of flair. You know, like, people are always like, oh, I'm a purist. Like, I love Brazilian football. But to me, Brazilian football has always had a real sort of, like, rugged tactical intelligence to it. You know, guys like Fernandinho, Casemiro, even Thiago Silva, and guys like Richarlison as well, who are like hardworking, smart. They're not just like, you know, soft, skillful players. They've got something else to them too. And I think that that's kind of what you want. Plus, you want somebody who can play up, who can play wide or up front. I think that's what you need at Spurs right now. So I was thinking about Orsolini, who we've talked about in the past. He's 24. He's at Bologna still. He's got 7 goals and assists in 1,000 minutes so far this season. About 0.49 expected goals and assists per 90, which is pretty good. It's about where Son was a couple of years ago. It's the same as it was last year. That's on a side which I think are 14th this season. I think they finished 12th last year. So he's playing for a pretty bad side and he's putting up very good attacking numbers. That to me is the sort of signing that Spurs should be looking to make. Like, lots and lots of shots. When you're taking over 3 shots a game as a winger, you probably can play up front. And creating a lot out of nowhere as well. Lots of dribbles completed. You know, nearly 2.5 dribbles completed a game. Really good at moving through the centre of the pitch. Really good as an outlet as well. Like, so you can look at players who receive progressive passes. I think he's in the top third of attackers for receiving progressive passes. So this is a guy who's a target between the lines for guys like Højbjerg, like Ndombele, like Lo Celso when he comes back, like Alderweireld. Also, he's going to track back. He's not going to do a huge amount of defensive work, but he's going to do enough. So I think that really you want to split the difference between a guy like Bale, who isn't really going to defend, and a guy like Lucas Moura, who's pretty much just a workhorse, you know, a fullback in kind of winger's clothing. So I think that this might be the sort of signing you can get. And again, for Spurs, £25 to £30 million, I think, is probably the sweet spot. Like, I'd be inclined to maybe try and shift some of their attackers this summer and maybe take a gamble on two players and just hope one explodes. That to me would kind of be good enough. I mean, also, I don't know if you've seen this, but on FBref, which is one of the stats websites that we use, they've now introduced this comparison tool.
Yeah, it's handy.
Yeah, so when I was looking at a player, I was like, let's look at who it suggests when I go to Heung-min Son. Who does it say is similar? And it suggested Marcus Thuram. Nice. And I thought that was really interesting as well, because Marcus Thuram, again, huge unit, great dribbler, really good creative numbers, but also a good goal scorer, could potentially be a striker in the long term. And after that, I thought maybe, you know, Pedro Neto feels like something Mourinho might do.
Nice.
Somebody who's Premier League experienced. He's had a great season on a team worse than Spurs. That feels kind of Mourinho-y.
Yeah, he's going to a Champions League club in the next couple of years as well, definitely.
Yeah, and I feel like if nobody comes in for him at kind of 50 mil this summer who is in the Champions League, if you're Spurs and you're in the Europa and you come in for that price, you might be able to get him. And if you can, then I think that that's somebody who's going to really explode for you over the next few seasons. And again, got great defensive work rate, can play in a variety of positions. He's Portuguese. You can imagine Mourinho seeing this and thinking, yeah, that's my guy. So I don't know. I kind of feel like any of these options would really improve Spurs. But I also feel that Mourinho is going to need to take the handbrake off a little bit. Like he's going to need to give whoever comes in a bit more license. So I mean, of all the attacking options we've discussed, who do you think would be the best signing for Spurs?
It's a tough one. I feel like Waman Gatuka is the one that excites me the most, but I don't see that happening. So I'd probably go Richarlison, but I think he's going to be very expensive. So
yeah, I don't think they're going to get Richarlison.
It's really difficult. I don't see Di Maria also swapping PSG for Spurs as well, particularly if they're going to be out of the Champions League. So maybe it's going to have to be an Orsolini. I mean, if they could get Marcus Thuram, I think that'd be awesome.
I think Marcus Thuram would be great. But I actually kind of agree with you. Like, the one I would like to see in the Spurs side is Waman Gatuka.
Yeah.
Like, I really do think that if Mourinho could open his eyes, like, that would be a great signing for him. But should we move on then just to a last few things, which is we were going to talk about who Spurs could sell and maybe a Hugo Lloris replacement, because it's getting to that point in his career where he might need to be rested a little bit more, kept fresh for the big games.
Absolutely. I think Lloris has actually done really well. I went through a phase a couple of years ago about sort of ranting about him and how Spurs needed to replace him, but full credit to him. Like, he's 34, he's in his ninth season at Spurs. He's been a great servant for the club, and he's generally, you know, saved more expected goals than he should. He's generally performed really well. I know he had that stinker against Liverpool the other day, and he didn't play great at the weekend against City either. Probably should have saved that Rodri penalty. But over his entire career, I feel like he can be very proud of his work at Spurs. I mean, he saved 11.3 expected goals in 18-19, 7.3 in 2019-20, and he's already at 4 this term. And that was going into the City game. I think only in terms of expected goals sort of saved, or the likelihood to save a shot that should go in, only Pope, Areola, Emi Martinez and Roberto Sanchez, the Brighton keeper who's newly into the side, rank higher than him in the squad. And no side going into that game against City had a bigger disparity between their goals conceded, 22, and their expected goals conceded, which was 28.4. And a lot of the credit there goes to Hugo Lloris, who has been awesome. But as you say, he's 34 now, Hart's 33. They do need to start thinking about the long-term future of that position. And I actually think a very cheap pickup in a potential summer where, actually, having spent a lot of money last summer, we're actually asking them to spend quite a lot of money this summer on fixing the holes in their squad, or at least the holes created by Mourinho's management of the squad, I should say. Then I feel like another keeper could be an option. Dean Henderson might not be a player that would be the worst one to look at, but I think actually the best player to look at who would be relatively cheap is Alphonse Areola, who has been awesome at Fulham, I think. 27 years old, he's obviously got PSG and Real Madrid on his CV. He's on loan at Fulham at the moment, so PSG might be willing to sell him. He's got a save percentage of 77% this term. Lloris is 79% for context. And he's got a very good long-range passing as well. He completes 49% of his long balls compared to Lloris's 46%. And I feel like he'd be ready to instantly go into that starting 11, and if not massively improve them, at least keep them on the same level in terms of their goalkeeper. So he might be one worth looking for.
Yeah, I kind of went the opposite end. I do think actually you're right that they can probably aim quite high, because they could sell Foyt, they've got Rose out of contract this summer. Obviously, Bale will go back to Madrid, Vinicius will go back. Aurier, Lamela, well, and actually Lloris are all out of contract in 2022. So there is some salary space.
You think Winks might leave as well, to be fair?
Interesting. I mean, I don't really know what to do with Winks, but maybe I'd keep him as your Højbjerg backup, I guess. I don't really have an issue with Winks as a squad player. I only have an issue with him as a starter. But I mean, I did find a cheap goalkeeping option here, which is a guy called Juan Musso, who plays for Udinese.
Okay.
He's 26. He's Argentinian. He was flagged by FB Ref as similar to Lloris and Oblak, which I was like,
not
okay,
bad company.
You've got my interest. So he's been starting for Udinese for the last three seasons, and his save percentage has been above 70% in all of those, which is pretty good. And before that, his save percentage was above 70% over a couple of seasons when he was playing in Argentina. I can't remember who it was with. It might have been Estudiantes. I can't remember. But anyway, he's been a good shot stopper his whole career. And in all of his seasons in Italy, he's outperformed post-shot expected goals. So on average, he's been saving his team about three goals a season, wow, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it is quite a lot.
It's quite solid, yeah.
Yeah, and he also ranks really highly for claiming crosses. So Lloris claims about 4% of high balls into the box. He comes out and catches them. Well, Musso is about twice that on 8%, which I think is a really good feature in the Prem for somebody to be commanding in their area. Even if it's something they're not asked to do that much. He's not as accurate a kicker as Lloris. He only completes about 40% of his long kicks, but I do think that maybe part of that is about the Spurs side itself. You know, I think when you're kicking long to guys like Son and Kane, who are really big guys, and actually Spurs are one of the tallest teams in the league, your completion rate on those long balls probably is a little bit higher. And we also see guys kick to the fullbacks quite a lot, who are pretty decent in the air as well. So I think that maybe Musso has some room to improve there. But the great thing about signing a guy like Musso is he doesn't immediately relegate Lloris to the bench.
Yeah.
I think that if you go and get a higher profile guy, you might have a difficult season where you're kind of, you know, chopping and changing between them and nobody knows who's number one. Whereas you bring in a guy like Musso, maybe for a year or two, he's Lloris' backup. And then when Lloris falls off, you've immediately got a guy who's top flight proven, ready to go into the side. And I think that makes quite a big difference. You know, like the drop off between your first choice keeper and your second choice keeper needs to exist so that you know who's number one. But it needs to not be too big that you're basically going down to a championship level keeper. So I think that might be an interesting one for them. And I reckon you'd probably get him for like 10 mil, which is pretty decent.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like that's quite a good option. The one thing with backup keepers, which I can't really think of an example of where the older keeper has just aged out and they've just used the backup keeper straight into the first team. There's such an idea that you need to then sign a new number one, which I think is quite bizarre, really. So yeah, if they brought in someone like Juan Musso, who I haven't seen, you know, play at all. I mean, by the sounds of things, he sounds great. But if they brought him in and then 2 years later moved him into number one, it would be probably quite a sensible move from Spurs.
Yeah, well, I mean, some sensible moves would be well advised. But what do you... just before we go, I would like to ask what you think is going to happen with Mourinho. I think we probably both imagine he makes it to the end of the season, but yeah, what do you think happens then? Where do you think Spurs finish? And where do Spurs need to finish for Mourinho to keep his job, do you think?
I think Spurs will finish probably sixth or seventh, to be honest. I can't really see them finishing much higher than that, particularly the way they're playing at the moment. But I just don't think they're going to get rid of Mourinho. Like, I feel like they've made such a commitment to his style of, to his ways, his style of play, with that decision to bring him in, which I didn't agree with at the time, but I feel like he's going to last more than one full season at the club. He'll point to the Carabao Cup final. He'll point to various problems in the league. He'll make some scapegoat. He'll say that he didn't quite get the players he wanted, probably, and there will be the slight grindings. I can actually see him being fired in about mid-October next year, which is probably not the sensible thing for Spurs to do, but I just don't see him losing his job pretty much under any circumstances, unless they finish just with about, I don't know, winning about 30% of their games to the back end of the year. They lose in the Europa League quarters or last 32 or last 16 or something, and just don't make any dents whatsoever. I actually think his job's quite safe because he's going to cost a lot of money to get rid of. And with Spurs' finances being so badly affected by the pandemic, I think more so than by a lot of clubs with that net spend last year on transfers and not being able to use this massive new stadium, I just don't think they can afford to get rid of him.
Yeah, that's a reasonable point. Though I always imagined that because this has been a problem with Mourinho in the past, paying off his contract when you sack him. And because Daniel Levy's pretty savvy, I kind of figured that when he hired Mourinho, especially because Mourinho wasn't in a position of strength, he didn't have a lot of people trying to hire him.
Yeah.
I wonder if maybe Levy has actually worked out a kind of a break clause at the end of each season where they can fire him without paying off his contract. I wonder if there's something like that in existence. But, I mean, the thing is, if he does deliver them a trophy, if they somehow manage to win the Carabao Cup, or if they, certainly if they win the Europa League, then he probably gets at least an extra 6 months on top of what he would have had anyway. But I think if they lose the Carabao Cup final, they don't win the Europa League, and they finish seventh, I think Mourinho, if they can afford it, I think they'll try and move him on. I really do.
Really?
Because it depends who they finish below. But like I say, I feel like if say, you know, Arsenal finished above them in sixth and Spurs finished seventh and they don't win a trophy, I think that's a really hard position for Spurs, especially with fans back in the stadium in the autumn. I think Spurs fans would be absolutely raging. So I think right now they need to finish above Arsenal and they need to probably finish... They need to either win a trophy or finish very, very close to the top four. But I don't think they're going to finish in the Champions League spots. I just think teams up there are better than them right now.
Yeah, I predicted them to finish fifth at the start of the year. And I think they could maybe get into that mix again. But we'll see. But yeah, as you say, it's a great point about the fans not being in the stadium. I think they've really been saved by that in the last month or so. Like, I think there'd be a lot of discontent from a lot of fans that when he was appointed, maybe not considering his failures at the back end of Chelsea and Man United, who are really excited, who will now start to be turning with the results and performances just simply not good enough.
Yeah, completely agree. Well, I think that brings us to the end for this week, Dukes. Is there anything that you'd like us to plug before we say goodbye?
Well, if you want to go watch a video on YouTube about another club that is struggling, go check out our EFD Explained on what has gone wrong at Celtic this year. It's a lot, to be honest. Manager, players, COVID. They've probably responded to the COVID situation worse than any club in Europe. So go and check that out on Eurofootball Daily.
Wowza. Yeah, that sounds great. And thank you very much for joining me today, Dukes. Thanks to you guys for watching or listening at home. Make sure that you're subscribed to Football Daily Podcast or subscribe to the podcast using whichever app you favour. Thanks very much, and we'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.